Going back to Acts chapter 27 tonight, Acts 27, and if you have your copy of the map from last week, you can pull that out. Would anybody like a map? This is our map to track Paul and his voyage here on his journey to Rome. I think some of you maybe have one, but if you don't, do you have them still? Don't know? Okay. Anybody need a map tonight? Raise your hand. All right, everybody knows where we are then, okay. Acts chapter 27 was just a brief report on, we did have the Ohio Bible Fellowship Conference down at Fayette Bible Church in Washington Courthouse on Saturday, and we had a couple messages from Pastor Nathaniel Pringle, who is down at Eastside Community Bible Church, and that's a church that was planted recently, the past, I think it's been 7 years or so now, but still fairly recently. I might pray for them as well. There's a place where they meet. They meet in a shopping area, kind of a business shopping center type place. They have a storefront, I guess would be the term. And they found out last month that the space next to them has been leased by another church, which is a Pentecostal church. And so, you know, if you're familiar with Pentecostal churches, you know, it's typically, you know, speaking in tongues, that sort of style of ministry, although, you know, could be born-again believers there. But it would kind of probably create a hardship for them, I think, in different ways, just to be right next to each other in a storefront like that, and sharing parking places and things like that. So their church is having to decide what the Lord would have them to do, whether to end their time and try to find another place. But I think it's something we could pray for them as well. So I just pray they'd be able to find a building, I think, ideally, is what they would need, their own building that would be kind of an independent place. I highly doubt we're going to have any churches planted right next to our building here. So I guess that's a blessing. Don't have to worry about that typically, although you never know. Could happen. Pray for that as well. All right, Acts chapter 27. We've been in a series here in Acts for quite some time. We're nearing the end. Acts 27, second to the last chapter. And we've been tracking Paul all throughout his journeys. And now Paul is on a different kind of journey. He's Paul, the prisoner of the Lord, at the end of the book of Acts. And he is one who has appealed to Caesar. That's the reason why he's on this journey. The various governors didn't know what to do with him back there in Caesarea, where he had been in prison for 2 years. And so finally they said, we got to send him to Caesar. We've got to send him to the emperor. And so we saw last week how Paul began this journey, and he was transported on two boats. If you have your map there, you can see it starts there, ultimately in Jerusalem, but then he went to Caesarea for 2 years, and then from Caesarea he starts this voyage, and we tracked him to Sidon, then to Myra. He got on another boat, and then from Myra makes a couple of other stops, and then he lands in Crete there, Fair Havens. And that's where they have this discussion about whether to venture out again or not. And Paul is saying, guys, we shouldn't do this. We are going to get in big trouble if we sail at this time of year. Remember, it was fall season, getting into winter. And historians tell us that at this time, there was a time of year that the Mediterranean Sea was considered closed to all travel. And this was the time that they were getting close to, and they hope to get over there to Phoenix to stay for the winter. or Phinehas, as it's called, I think, in, I forget what verse that is, but they hope to get there. They never do, because they get involved in a giant storm. It's a storm. It's a tempestuous wind, verse 14 told us. And that word in the original is a word we get the word typhoon from. So it is that strength of a storm, kind of a hurricane type storm that Paul is in with these other prisoners, these soldiers. He also has a friend whose name was Aristarchus, and then also Luke is with him. But they're in the middle of the storm. It looks like all hope is lost. And then Paul has the opportunity in the midst of the storm to be an encouragement to the people. And we'll just review that here. Pick it up there in verse 21, Acts 27, verse 21. But after long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me and not have loosed from Crete and to have gained this harm and loss." So he's saying, "I told you so. You should have listened to me. And now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, 'Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar. And lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me. Howbeit, we must be cast upon a certain island.'" So Paul is encouraging the people there. They think all hope is lost, but Paul has a word from God saying, "No, you're going to make it." And so we saw last week how Paul was able to testify there. God didn't have any trouble finding this ship that was in the midst of this storm in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. Somehow he was able to send an angel right to Paul's side on that ship. He knew where Paul was. And Paul knew who he was. He was the servant of God. He says, "Whose I am and whom I serve." He knew he belonged to God, and he served God, and God had promised to be with him and to protect him here. And that's where we left it last week. And so that was our review. Now we'll get into verse 27 and finish out the voyage here. "But when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in Adria, about midnight the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country, and sounded and found it 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they sounded again and found it 15 fathoms. Then fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast 4 anchors out of the stern and wished for the day." So what we see happening in these verses is they are nearing land. We see them taking a sounding here, and say, "Well, what's a sounding?" Well, it's a measurement of some sort. When I first read that, I thought, "Wait a minute, they don't have any sort of radio type sounding equipment to determine the length of." Or the depth of the water there. How are they doing this? How do you think they're doing it? How are they taking a sounding? Right, this is the first century. Well, probably a rope and a weight on the end of the rope, all right? They have a weight there, and they've got some kind of rope. Throw that out. Boom, all right? They hit the bottom, okay? Pull it back up. How long was that? Well, the first time they did it, it was 20 fathoms. A fathom, traditionally, is the measurement of a man's arm stretched out horizontally. Okay, so if somebody were to come up here and measure my arms like this, that would be close to a fathom, I guess. It would vary from person to person, but I don't think I've ever measured this. But in some of the NBA players, it's really big, it's long. But it's probably not that big for me. One commentator said that this distance would have been about 120 feet the first time they took this sounding. And then they did it again. They sounded again threw out that rope again, and it was 15 fathoms. And so they start to get worried. The measurement is smaller. What does that mean? Well, they can't see anything around them, but that depth of the water is getting more and more shallow. And now if any of you have ever gone swimming in an ocean or in a lake or something, you know, the farther out you go, usually the deeper it gets. As you're getting close to land, it's more shallow. And so they know that it's getting more and more shallow, and they're afraid. Why? Because they know that if that ship gets any closer, they're going to crash. They're going to crash on that the floor of the sea, the rocks there. And so they put down these anchors here, and they hope that they can just stay put until the day comes, verse 29. But then something else happens here as they're nearing land. There's a little treachery that takes place. Look at verse 30. And as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, when they had let down the boat into the sea under color, as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, "Except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved." And the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall off. But what was happening here? Well, we have the shipmen that are getting a little bit scared. Who are the shipmen? They are the sailors. They are the ones in charge of running the ship. They're the ones that are actually trying to navigate and sail the ship. And they start to get a little bit selfish. They think, we got to get out of here. This we're doomed on this ship. We've got to escape. So they pretend like they're going to do something with the anchors, and actually what they're doing is letting down the ship's boat, the little boat that they were carrying. And those sailors, those rascal sailors, they were going to get in that little boat and make their way to land and leave everybody else to die. Well, somehow Paul finds out about that, and he alerts the centurion, the guy who was the military presence there, and he says, don't let this happen. Don't let these guys escape. We got to stay together. We can't just let the sailors go. We need them. They were the ones who knew how to sail the ship. Everybody else was just a landlubber, you know, and they don't know how to sail a ship. And if the sailors leave, it's not going to be good. And so what does the centurion do? Verse 32, then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall off. So they eliminate that problem. They say, we are not going to take this little boat with us at all. So the soldiers just set her free, cut her off, and there goes that little tiny boat off into the storm. And nobody can escape on that boat. I think we see a lesson here about using the means that God has given us. God had promised that he was going to save the Apostle Paul. Paul had that promise. Paul could have just said, hey, it's okay. Anything that happens, it's fine. God said he's going to save me. And sure, the sailors, they want to escape. See ya. Go ahead. We're going to be fine. But you notice that Paul doesn't do that. He has this promise from God, but at the same time, he also is trying to, make use of things that make sense. We need sailors to sail the ship, all right? We don't want to let them go. And so, he's trying to use what God has given him there on that boat. Matthew Henry, in his commentary, makes this comment. He says, God, who appointed the end that they should be saved, appointed the means that they should be saved by the help of these seamen. Though if they'd gone off, no doubt God would have made his word good some other way. Paul speaks as a prudent man, not as a prophet, when he says these are necessary to your preservation. Duty is ours. Events are God's. We do not trust God, but tempt him when we say we put ourselves under his protection and do not use proper means, such as are within our power for our own preservation. So, you know, there's times when we do have to make decisions and use what God has given us, at the same time, trust God. And that's what Paul was doing there in that ship. He was making decisions. He was alerting people to potential problems there. And at the same time, God was using all that to save the whole, everybody on board that ship. All right, as we move on, we find they're nearing land. And then the second thing that happens is they eat some food. Look at verse 33. And while the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take meat, saying, "This day is the 14th day that ye have tarried and continued fasting, having taken nothing. Wherefore I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health, for there shall not an hair fall from the head of any of you." And when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in presence of them all, and when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then were they all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. And we were in all the ship 216 souls. When they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. So we see here that Paul encourages everybody to eat. Evidently, that it had been a long time since they had eaten. It says 14th day. You know, it had been 2 weeks since they had really had a good meal. Maybe they were snacking or something on different things, but they really hadn't had, you know, real serious food or perhaps any food at all. I mean, they were fasting the whole time. This wasn't an intermittent fasting. This was, you know, the whole time. And Paul says, we have got to eat some food. This isn't going to be good if we don't eat. He says, this is for your health. The word health there in the original is the word actually for salvation. You know, talking about their preservation in that sense, not a spiritual salvation, but just, you know, if you don't eat, you're not going to survive. This is for your preservation here in this storm. They probably wouldn't have felt much like eating, I think, if they thought they were about to die, you know, out there in the storm. Why eat? You know, why eat if you think you're not going to survive the day? And so that seems to be kind of the mentality there on the ship. And Paul has to kind of change that. Say, you have to eat. You got to eat something here. And notice what he does next. He eats himself. He eats for himself. All right. Verse 35. When he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. When he had broken it, he began to eat. So Paul takes the lead in eating. Maybe some of you are good at that. You know, whenever there's eating, you're taking the lead in eating. And that was Paul here. He was leading through eating this meal. But it was more than that, really. He was demonstrating by his own actions that he believed that God was going to keep him safe. And because he believed that, he was going to eat this meal. And he was praying to God, giving thanks. And we see the effect that it had here. Verse 36, then were they all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. So everyone can see Paul and how Paul is acting, and it has an effect on everybody else on board. Okay, Paul is acting this way. He's eating. He seems calm enough to sit down and eat some of this food we have on board. Okay, maybe this is going to turn out okay. You know, you can imagine how things would be if Paul was freaking out. You know, and Paul is supposed to be this man of God, and he is saying, "Oh no, what's going to happen?" You know, he was just, okay, sitting down, eating this meal, praying, and everybody else is put at ease they're encouraged by that. They're going to need some energy too. They're about to go swimming. And, you know, if you go swimming, that typically demands a lot of calories. And if you haven't eaten in a long time, you're going to need to store up those calories. But we see here that, you know, for one thing, something as simple as a prayer before eating a meal is a powerful testimony. That's all Paul did. Of course, he was there in the midst of a storm, but he sat down, he prayed, he ate this meal. And then we also see the power of teaching and preaching by example. Here was Paul. He's trying to encourage everybody, trying to tell them about God. And he does this simple thing, sit down and eat a meal. But it was a way that he was walking the walk, so to speak. He was showing people by his own example that he really believed what he was preaching. He really did believe that God was going to save him. So he is eating. He's taking this his nourishment because he knows he's going to live another day. And so he needs to go ahead and do this. But the power of teaching by example, that's what Paul was doing here. So they ate and they all cheered up. You know, there's probably some bad attitudes there and some sour spirits, but they had this meal. Feel better now. And you know, maybe some of you still need to do that tonight and maybe cheer up. But that's what happened. And then we're told here how many people were on board. Notice what it says there. 216 souls, verse 37. Translate that to 276. And perhaps the reason they put that number there is because typically when you have a meal, it's always nice to know how many people you got to serve. And so, you know, maybe they knew, or Luke was involved in giving out the food they had. Okay, we've got 276. Let's divide up this food we have. So they eat, they cheer up, and then what do they do here? Verse 38, when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. They throw out what they have left here. They're lightening the ship, making it less heavy, throwing things overboard. We see the same word used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, in the book of Jonah. Similar situation there. You remember Jonah was in a storm, and the sailors there, they do the same thing. Of course, they're crying to their gods, but it says they cast forth the wares that were in the ship into the sea to lighten it of them. And you know, they want to be on top of the water as much as possible. They don't want to be pulled down with the cargo that they have. If they're going to make it to shore. So they throw out the rest of the food. They've had their last supper on the ship, and they lighten the ship, cast it out into the sea. And then the final section here of this chapter, we come to the actual shipwreck, verses 39 to 44. Verse 39, and when it was day, they knew not the land, but they discovered a certain creek with a shore, into the which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in the ship. And when they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves unto the sea and loosed the rudder bands and hoisted up the mainsail to the wind and made toward shore. And falling into a place where the two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the forepart stuck fast and remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. The soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land, and the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land. So they begin here with finding a particular place here near the shore, and it's said that they discovered or they knew not the land. In other words, they didn't recognize where they were. They're getting close to land, but these sailors, they're thinking, you know, we've never seen this before. This isn't an area that we're familiar with. But it says they discovered a certain creek with a shore. Now, when I see the word creek, I have a certain picture in my mind of what a creek is. I'm thinking of this huge boat, and how is that boat going to fit in this creek? Well, the word creek here in the original is a word that refers to a part of the sea that's partially enclosed by land. In other words, a bay or a gulf of some sort. So they see that formation as they're getting closer to the land here. There's this bay, and it says it has a shore. The word shore here is a word that refers to a strip of land immediately bordering the edge of a body of water. You could call it a beach. All right? They see a bay with a beach. And now that might put another picture in your mind. And remember, there's a storm going on. Okay? This is not a vacation destination. But they see this bay, and they're thinking, hey, if we can just get to that area, that would be great. So we see what they do. To do that, we have all kinds of different shipping terminology here in verse 40. When they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves unto the sea and loosed the rudder bands. So there were some sort of bands that were around the steering mechanism there, which they loosed. It says they hoisted up the mainsail. This mainsail, as it's called, to my understanding, is not the biggest sail, but it's a smaller sail on the boat, which would have allowed them to have some control as they got closer to this bay. So they put up this smaller sail in order to hopefully be able to steer this thing and get it as close as they can into this bay. And made toward shore. Then verse 41, and falling into a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground. Now, what's going on here with these two seas that met here? The idea may be that what happens is they come to a place where there is deep water on one side and deep water on the other side. You have these two deep areas, and they're meeting here in the middle, meeting in a very shallow area, like a sandbar. If you can imagine that, sand kind of rising up there in that bay, and they're headed towards that, or whether they realize it or not, we're told that it gets stuck. They ran the ship aground there, perhaps in this sandbar, and the forepart stuck fast and remained unmovable. Now we have another shipping term here. What would be our name for that part of the ship, the forepart of the ship? The bow, right. That would be the bow, the front of the ship. And so that gets run into the sandbar here, and it remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken. What would be our name for the hinder part of the ship? The stern, right. The stern of the ship. And so the hinder part is out there facing the waves, and those violent waves are beating against that ship. They're breaking up the stern. And so the ship is getting wrecked up here in this bay area. And then what happens? The soldiers, they're thinking, oh no, we're close to land. We got all these prisoners here. They're going to escape. And, the Roman policy for the soldiers who were guarding prisoner was, if they lose those prisoners, the penalty that those prisoners were going to get, that's what the soldiers were going to get. You remember the Philippian jailer, when Paul and Silas were there in Philippi and the earthquake happens and all the prisoners are set free, he's about to kill himself. Why? Because he's going to be accountable for all those prisoners that escape. And that's what these soldiers are thinking. We're in big trouble. We're close to land. These prisoners are going to escape, and let's just kill them all. But we see that the centurion intervenes. Verse 43, but the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose. You know, there's so many times that this ship was saved. The people on this ship were preserved physically because of Paul. Whether they knew that or not, it was true. This man, Julius is his name, the centurion. This was a man who had come to learn that there was something special about the Apostle Paul. He had rejected Paul's advice back there on Crete and went ahead and sailed anyway. But now he was coming around to realize, wait a minute, Paul is somebody that I need alive. And it was for Paul's sake that he saves those prisoners from death. One commentator says this, believers are often a source of help for people in general, at times unknowingly. And I think that's probably true today. Oftentimes, we may not even know about it, that God preserves people around us, around other believers, for the sake of those believers, and protects them. And of course, oftentimes those believers that are hated and that get in trouble with people. Unfortunately, the world doesn't realize what the Bible tells us about how God protects His own and even the people around them. And then after that, it's every man for himself here. The centurion commands, verse 43, that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land. Almost makes you want to take some swimming lessons if you don't know how to swim. You know, the whole crew of that ship, all the passengers, they were safe. Perhaps some of them floating on pieces of the ship, Swiss Family Robinson style, to this island. And of course, they make it there to that island. Chapter 28, that island of Melita. And then we'll see, Lord willing, next time what happens there. So if you see the map, I guess it's called Malta there, another spelling. But that's where they are now. They're shipwrecked just on a bay outside, or right inside Malta there on that island. And the Lord preserves them there, all because of the Apostle Paul. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for how you protect your own. We thank you for your presence, even in times when we feel like we don't understand what's going on. We wonder if you're still in control. But we see how you saved your servant Paul and those that were with him. And we pray that you would give us the faith that Paul had to be able to be an example to others by trusting in you, by being an encouragement to others. And I pray that you would help us in that, help us to learn the lessons we need to learn tonight, even from this passage. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's take our hymnals as we close.